Welcome to Open Your Eyes, a podcast about empowering each of us with the perspective and tools to grow and change. Thanks for joining us today. We're excited about the reach of this podcast to other places in the world. Did you know that 2% of our listeners are in China, 1.5% in Australia, over 1% in Malaysia, and another 3% in Singapore, Brazil, Taiwan, Mexico, and the Philippines? We're reaching many corners of the world. And thus far in our podcast, the number of unique listeners on Apple, Spotify, and Audible have reached 68,000, who have in total done hundreds of thousands of downloads. We're most excited about this podcast reaching you. And I hope wherever you are, you gain some inspiration from this podcast today. And you can open your eyes a bit more to how to think and live better. And if you hear something today that helps you, please share the link to this podcast with a friend. It just may be what they need in their life today. Let's get started. Today, I'd like to talk about how you will measure your life. In Central Asia, there's a small country of about 56,000 square miles, about the same size as Iowa, where 30 million people live quietly. The country ranks 150th in per capita income, with the average adult earning about $450 US per month. With China to the north and India to the south, Nepal is home to 8 of the world's 10 tallest mountains. It was in Nepal, in a remote village on the border with Tibet, that Sun Duk Ryut was born. His village of 200 people sat at 11,000 feet above sea level. It was in this most remote region of Nepal, with no electricity, schools, healthcare facilities, or any other means of modern communication, that he grew up. And the village was blanketed by snow for 9 months of the year. The nearest school was a 15-day walk to St. Robert's School in Darjeeling, India. His father sent Sunduk there at the age of 7, where he stayed for 5 years. His father believed in the power of education. Sunduk would return to Nepal, attend graduate school in Kathmandu, and go on to study medicine in India. While working in an eye hospital in Nepal, Sunduk met an Australian ophthalmologist named Fred Hollows, and he was invited to study in Australia and later in the United States. In Australia, Sunduk specialized in eye surgery, and together with Hollows developed a surgical technique that inserted intraocular lenses into the eye using small incisions. This process revolutionized cataract surgery, making it inexpensive. You see, the biggest barrier in the world to providing cataract surgery is the cost. Cataracts impact over 95 million people in the poorest countries and is the leading cause of blindness. And 90% of the world's blind live in low-income countries where cataract surgery is not available or too expensive. And women account for nearly 75% of cataract blindness and don't receive surgery at the same rate as men. The cost of Sunduk's new lenses were only $5 US, and it was then that he decided he was on a mission, that he would make eye surgery affordable and accessible to every person in Nepal, regardless of their economic situation. In fact, if he could remove cataract blindness, it would lift millions of people and even countries out of poverty. A significant portion of his work is not the delivery of surgeries to cure blindness, but outreach activities to locate patients and convince them to accept the free treatment. Locating patients living in remote and rural areas with low social standing because they've been disfranchised from society because they're blind is difficult. Many of the people who are living in poverty with needless blindness can't even afford to travel to obtain free eye care. In reality, what might seem like a medical challenge is actually a marketing and logistics challenge. But Sunduk and his foundation are screening millions of people and curing up to 500,000 of needless cataract blindness. On January 14th, 1929, Dashrath Manji was born into the Musahars, the lowest possible caste in Indian society, which is quite literally translated as rat eaters. Raised in India, Manji was married to a local village girl named Falguni and sent to work and live on site at the coal mines of Dhanbad. 7 years of hard labor, he finally returned home, became a day laborer, and started a family. With one child at home and another on the way, he made no qualms about toiling for $1 a day in order to put food on the table. But tragically, it was during a seemingly normal day at work in 1959 that his pregnant wife had her fatal accident. While bringing her husband food and water along this steep mountainous terrain, she slipped. When a villager notified Manji of the accident, he ran off to find her at the bottom of a cliff. The clinic to treat her was miles away and not reachable by car. So, after she passed, he decided to do something to prevent future accident victims from the same fate. For 22 years, he worked to make a safer road through the mountains. He burned firewood on the rocky terrain and splashed the heated surface with water to chisel away at the cracked boulders and turn them into rubble. People told Manji he wouldn't be able to carve a road into the mountain. His nephew told him, "You're a poor man who just needs to earn and eat." But Manji did more than that. He plowed fields to earn money during the day and resumed his personal project at night. He was able to complete the path through the mountain, literally cutting a ravine in the mountain that was 360 feet long and changed the lives of local villagers. The 35 miles they previously had to walk in order to go around the mountains were now cut down to 10, and nobody had the fear of dying along the journey. Well, he's since passed away, but he left a path to those who lived and worked in poverty, making their lives better. Here's the point. For both Sandok and Dasharath, you can easily measure their life. You can measure the cataract surgeries given to the poor in Nepal, and you can measure the miles of travel saved and the lives saved because of Dasharath's new mountain pass. But for you and me, the measure of our life may not be so straightforward. And the question of the day is, how will you measure your life? Years ago, Clayton Christensen wrote a book with the title, How Will You Measure Your Life? In his opening chapter, he describes the lives of his classmates at Harvard University as he observed them at several subsequent class reunions. Among his classmates were executives at McKinsey and Goldman Sachs and many Fortune 500 companies. And he notes that many of his classmates were unhappy. For many, their lives didn't turn out as they wanted, despite their education and success. And this caused him to think about the measures we use to measure our life. He noted that for the people who achieve or rise in a hierarchical sense within an organization and get a title or acquire wealth, we often think their lives are better or of more value. But that's because we choose to measure things that way. But what if, in the end, when we're measured against things that really matter, we discover the yardstick or measure we used in life caused us to pursue something other than what we value at the end of our days? As Stephen Covey said, if the ladder is not leaning against the right wall, every step we take just gets us to the wrong place faster. Well, Clayton shares his experience that partway through his life, he didn't get an opportunity that he thought should have come his way. He had hoped and thought and worked for it, but he didn't get it. And this caused him once again to consider what's really important. And he realized the circumstances of where he lived or his title really didn't matter. It was what he did in those circumstances that did matter. And he suggests God will evaluate us personally on what we did with the circumstances in which we were placed, and how we helped others who were placed in those same circumstances with us. In other words, a real measure of success is how did we serve in our circumstance. When I learned this lesson from Clayton, everything changed in my mind. You mean to tell me that my life will be measured by how I helped people who were in my current circumstance? That means I can focus less on my circumstance. It doesn't matter my title. It doesn't matter where it has led me. It means I'm measured by how I serve in my circumstance. You see, too many of us focus so long on our circumstances that we lose sight of how our life will be measured. And when I learned this lesson, when I opened my eyes to this, many things changed for me. Soon, my teaching was different, my leadership, my parenting. I had more time for others. You see, my yardstick for success changed. And something else powerful happened. When my circumstances change, whether good or bad, I don't worry that my title changed or I led a larger or a smaller organization. I simply look around for who I was supposed to help in those circumstances. And could it be that you've been placed in your circumstances, your family, your business, to see how you will serve in that circumstance? Will you cut a hole in the mountain to make travel easier for others, so to speak? Well, later in life, Christensen said, "This past year, I was diagnosed with cancer and faced the possibility that my life would end sooner than I had planned. Thankfully, it now looks as if I'll be spared, but the experience has given me important insights into my life. As I've confronted this disease, it's been interesting to see how unimportant several things are to me now. I've concluded that the metric by which God will assess my life isn't dollars, but the individual people whose lives I've touched." And I think that's the way it works for all of us. Don't worry about the level of individual prominence you've achieved. Worry about the individuals you've helped to become better people. "This is my final recommendation," he says. "Think about the metric by which your life will be judged and make a resolution to live every day so that in the end, your life will be judged a success." So here's something else that I've learned. There's no shortcut to happiness and meaning in life. Until you allocate your resources to what's important, it doesn't matter. The best time, for example, to take care of your health and relationships is now, not when you need them most. Perhaps we could get extreme clarity about our life and what's important to us. And knowing these few things, we could then commit to them. The small things that we do every day could be committed to that end and would accumulate to lead our life to measuring up in life. So, once you know how you will measure your life, you can then allocate your life's resources to this end. So, what resources do you have to spend or allocate? Well, first, of course, is time. It's amazing how 15 or 30 minutes a day spent on what's most important adds up and will provide a cumulative effect to make your life remarkable. For example, if you want good health, 30 minutes a day of exercise will lengthen your life, give you more energy, help you feel better about yourself, and provide what you need to serve and give. The opposite is also true. Poor health will rob you of the energy and ability to do what you set out to do in life. Focus is another resource. Each day, you get to choose what you'll focus on. Priorities are a resource. Energy, thought, emotion, passion, and love are all resources you can spend on what matters most to you. Each day, you get to choose to love what you do or not. Each day, you get to act as if you were in love with your business or family or team, because all of us work, live, and act with more energy when we're in love. Where there's love, there's life. Where there is love, there is sunshine and warmth and happiness in what you do. You know, when you're in love, driving all night to see the person you're in love with is no big deal. When you use love, you work better. You're more authentic. People see your love and passion, and you're more attractive to others. You lead better. You're more convincing. You have more influence. You know, when my son was a teenager, getting him up for school to wake up for anything was impossible. It was like his alarm clock never worked. I bought him a new alarm clock, but it didn't matter. He couldn't wake up. It never worked. It was a mystery why I kept getting faulty alarm clocks. Then he made the football team, and they had weightlifting every morning at 6 a.m. It's funny, I never had to wake him up. Somehow his alarm clock worked every day during football season because he loved football. After football season was over, the alarm clock broke again. Love does something amazing. It gives you power to focus, to care, to put in extra effort. It's stronger than fear, hurt, worry, anxiety, failure. None of these stand a chance in the face of love. Each day, you get to choose what you do with your love, where you will spend it. It's an extremely useful exercise to take a minute each morning and ask yourself, how will I fall in love with what I am doing today? Now, Too often we get to measuring our life and feel in the midst of a huge trial or not succeeding or after we make mistakes that we should just give up. We don't measure up. And I felt this a lot in my life, that I wasn't measuring up on what matters most. But I've learned something very important. Thomas Edison says, our greatest weakness lies in giving up. The most certain way to succeed is always to try just one more time. You know, earlier in life, I was a bit of a marathon runner. I still run, just slower and shorter than I used to. But I ran a number of marathons during my 40s and 50s. And what I learned about running a marathon is simple. It always takes more energy and effort than you thought possible. It takes more training, more desire, more endurance than you thought possible. And the funny thing is, the easiest marathon I ran was my first marathon. Why? It was new and exciting, and everyone was talking about it, and my family was there cheering me on. It was easy to find the energy and effort to finish. The hardest marathon was the third and the fourth. In those marathons, no one was watching. I'd done marathons before, so the luster had worn off. Expectations were higher because I'd run a marathon before and should beat my previous time, right? Other people who trained with me on my first marathon had stopped or were doing other things, so I was left to myself. And on the trying, difficult days, I often asked myself, why am I doing this? You see, that's when you learn a lot about yourself and whether you can persevere, whether you can keep trying. No doubt in your life or business, you've experienced the same. When the luster is gone and you must persevere and decide to do it again because you know deep down that you're a runner or a business person, it takes courage and faith and belief to decide again. The second thing I learned from running marathons is this. Every day when I ran, I had one picture in mind, what it would feel like to cross the finish line in the time I had set for myself. This image of the finish line carried me through rain and cold and aches and pain. A clear image of where you're headed, a clear, well-defined image makes all the difference. I learned that in running and other things, it isn't over until you reach your goal. It took me 11 marathons to reach my first goal time. My other friends did it much faster. This is almost 5 years of training and running to reach that goal. But I learned it isn't over until you win. A long time ago, I met Les Brown. He told us a story of playing the game Connect Four with his son and the lesson of it's not over till I win. You see, his son wouldn't quit until he won. And inspired by his words, I went home and shared this message with my kids and bought a Connect Four game. I was hoping to teach them the lesson of perseverance that Les taught me. Well, the following week, child number four, 10-year-old Elizabeth, pulled out the game and we started to play. After I had won about 10 times in a row, I was tired and wanted to stop. Like Les Brown taught, she said defiantly, "Keep playing, Dad. It's not over till I win." So we kept playing. After I won another 5 games, I was ready to quit. She said again, "Set up the game, Dad. It's not over till I win." After another 5 games, the same thing, but this time with tears in her eyes, she said, "It's not over till I win." We played on. On game 27, I didn't see 3 checkers lined up, and she connected 4 and told me, "Now it's over. I have won." Since I've seen this attitude in her to graduate from college, serve in foreign countries, be a wonderful mother, and do very tough things in life. It's not over till you win. You are not finished. You'll not slow down. You'll not falter, stop until you win, until you finish what you started. It's not over till you win. Now, you may say, "McKay, I'm nothing special. I'm mediocre at best." Well, join the club. I'm mediocre. This podcast room is filled with mediocre. And as I've said before, the origin of the word mediocre is mediocris, which means halfway up the mountain. And that's what I am. That's what you are. We're just halfway towards who we're meant to become. And you may say, "But I set a goal and I start strong and I get into the work of it. And the negative things, the negative thinking, the negative feeling gets the best of me and I lose my motivation." I don't care what you're doing. If it's worthwhile, it'll be challenging and the negative will come. The trick is to make sure you always have more positive emotion than negative. You must add fuel to your goal. Next, We can measure our life differently if we see things as they really are. If we can open our eyes to how God is working in our life to change us and make us more like Him, then our circumstances, as bad as they might be, become our own personal school for learning more about God and ourselves. And this makes life rich. This makes things bearable. For several years, I worked alongside a good man by the name of Dallin. Here is his lesson. His wife, April, was expecting their third child. They went to an ultrasound appointment to see whether they were having a boy or a girl. They learned they were having a son, but they also discovered some heartbreaking news. There were several physical complications. Their son was missing large portions of his brain. His skull wasn't properly shaped, and the doctors weren't even sure he would live. They would get the news that their son didn't have a right eye. They prayed and sought to understand why this had happened to them. Well, their son Caleb survived his birth, and it became evident immediately that Caleb would be unable to develop in his life. He would never feed himself or be able to hold his head up on his own. Dallin said, "I remember being terrified as we walked out of the hospital with our little boy to take him home. The number of machines and medical equipment we needed to sustain his life was overwhelming, and the possibility of losing him was a constant fear. Simply feeding him required extraordinary effort because he needed to eat every 3 hours, and the process to eat took 1 hour to complete. We wondered how we would keep ourselves alive, let alone our fragile son." Well, Dallin continued, "My wife April purposefully chose hope and trust in God. To her core, she is happy and optimistic. With God's help, she took what could have been a terrifying trial and reshaped it. She took a corner of heaven and pulled it right down into our home, opening it up for all to enjoy. Every day became a celebration with Caleb. She made a birthday cake for him after his first week, cupcakes for his second week, cookies for his third week, and so on. She celebrated everything about Caleb, for every day was truly a once-in-a-lifetime experience for the boy who was sent home from the hospital with no hope. His missing eye became a source for hope. April explained to our children, Caleb was winking, and a wink means, I love you. Don't worry, April would say, he will just wink at us every day. Well, Caleb lived for 7 incredible years, and Dallin says he became a different man in the process. What he learned, how he opened his eyes to a new perspective and grew, is amazing to him and to me. Dallin said, at this time, I thought that we were taking care of Caleb. But in reality, God, through Caleb, had been taking care of us. God was making a miracle where I hadn't expected one. He was performing a miracle on me, on my wife, on our kids, and all those who came in contact with Caleb. Having Caleb in our home was an honor and a privilege. It was a sacred experience. Well, the truth is, we're all a work in progress, and the circumstances of our life are here for a reason. And it's our job to seek and find and fulfill that purpose. And while the purpose of all the things that happen to us are not fully evident right now, they will be known and are known by your Maker. So lean in to what you're facing right now. Find a way to love everything about it. Use the power of love to make your time, your life, remarkable. You know, there's something else amazing that happens when we figure out what's most important to us in life. You get to employ your faith, and faith is incredibly powerful. If you decide, like Sundock, that you want to eliminate cataracts in the poor in Nepal, you must have faith that you can find the resources and means to reach all these people. If you decide to authentically love your family in all circumstances, you'll need faith to give your strength to do this. In the New Testament is a wonderful story about faith that most people are very familiar with. After Jesus performs a miracle in feeding 5,000 people, he instructs his disciples to board a ship and cross the Sea of Galilee, while he remains behind to send away the multitude and to pray. There on the sea, a windstorm comes up during the voyage, and the small ship in which the men were traveling was tossed among the waves. To add to their distress, the disciples were confronted with what they thought was a ghost, a spirit they could see approaching, and they cried out in fear. What they actually saw was Jesus walking on the water towards them. Although Jesus announced that it was He, that they didn't need to fear, some on the ship were skeptical. Peter challenged, "If it be thou, bid me come unto thee on the water." And Jesus responded, "Come." Well, Peter left the boat and, like Jesus, walked on the water. But partway, Peter's attention was diverted from his master to the buffeting winds and the waves around him, and his faith began to weaken, and he began to sink helplessly into the water. He cried out, appealing to Jesus for help. After clasping Peter's hand and assuring his safety, Jesus mildly chastised Peter, "O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt?" Then Jesus came aboard the boat and the wind ceased. Now, sometimes when I hear this story, I hear people refer to Peter as having failed because Jesus asked him, "Why did you doubt?" But I don't think that's what happened or what Jesus was saying. I believe this experience was a significant source of faith to Peter throughout his life. I imagine that Peter looked back on that event many times and said to himself, "I had the courage to walk on water, and for a time, I did the impossible." I believe it fed his faith. I also believe Jesus wasn't chastising Peter when he asked, "Why did you doubt?" I believe he asked the question like a teacher would ask. So in answering, Peter could learn the power of keeping his faith about him and staying focused on his Lord, especially in times when there's commotion around him. Peter would need this lesson later in life as he captained the ship of the Lord's church. Now, I love this story because I believe you too can do the impossible if you don't doubt or give away your faith. You may not walk on water, but you will walk in places you have never walked before and in ways you never thought you could if you will keep your faith. I believe you have the ability to do what may seem impossible in your life. Perhaps you're needing to change. Don't doubt. Perhaps you're attempting something remarkable you've never done before. Don't doubt. Perhaps you're doing something again that you have done before, but this time need to rise and do better. Don't doubt. Feed your faith and your doubts will starve. Robert Kriegel wrote, "We don't have a clue as to what people's limits are. All the tests, stopwatches, and finish lines in the world can't measure human potential. When someone is pursuing their dream, they'll go far beyond what seems to be their limitations. The potential that exists within us is limitless and largely untapped. When you think of limits, you create them." I believe that's true. You can do what you set out to do. Be who you desire to become and create a life that will be rewarding and remarkable. In the end, as St. Augustine said, "Faith is to believe what you do not see, and the reward of faith is to see what you have believed." So as we end today, remember the answer to the question, how will you measure your life? Spend some time answering this question and watch. You will direct your life and love and faith in ways that will bring you to the place where you're measuring up in ways that matter most. Most of all, thanks for being here today. And don't forget to join us next week for another episode as we seek to open our eyes to who and what we can become.